people are beginning to pay attention and to recognize that it's time to do things differently. We have the knowledge, the data, the tools and approaches to direct investment in nature to solve many different types of urban problems. Using these approaches today will help cities of the future become more sustainable, livable, resilient, and equitable.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Green Cities podcast series, produced by USAID's Green Cities Division. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. USAID created the Green Cities Division in late 2020, reflecting a recognition that an urban transformation toward green cities is integral to the sustainable development agenda. The Green Cities Division is launching the Green Cities Program, a new global mechanism for missions, regional bureaus, and technical offices to work on urgent environment and human development issues in rapidly growing urban and peri-urban areas. The Green Cities Program will draw on unique external expertise to modernize and scale USAID's urban programs. This 3-part podcast series explores the role sustainable and inclusive urbanization can play in addressing multiple USAID priorities, like air quality, water resources, ocean plastics, gender equality, climate change, urban resilience, biodiversity, and economic growth. In this, our 3rd and final episode, we look ahead to the next 25 to 50 years. 60% of the urban areas that are expected to be on the planet in 2050 have yet to be built. The demand for urban spaces is growing. Construction is happening. Landscapes are changing. Ecosystems are being shaped and reshaped. What are the challenges we are going to face moving forward? What are the big ideas that can be adopted, embraced, and that will transform the role of cities in international development? We are joined in this episode by our guests.
I'm Anne Gary, the Chief Strategy Officer and Lead Scientist at the Natural Capital Project at Stanford and a Senior Research Associate at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment.
I'm Rogier van den Berg. I'm the Acting Global Director for World Resources Institute's Ross Center for Sustainable Cities.
I'm Joanna Lavecchio. I'm the Associate Director of the Center for Resilient Cities and Landscapes at Columbia University.
As we look ahead to building the cities of 2050, and rebuilding the cities we already have, what are the questions we should be asking ourselves? What are the moonshot ideas that we need in order to transform the role cities can play to address international development priorities? Anne offers some of these key questions and even challenges us to rethink the whole concept of a quote, moonshot idea.
So first I have to say that, you know, moonshot is probably not the right word. We sort of need more of an earth shot. We need so much more work on nature-based solutions and green infrastructure in cities. When and where do they work? What problems do they solve? And for whom? How do we maximize co-benefits and return on investment? How do we ensure that benefits are distributed equitably? We just need to do more experimentation. We need to get green infrastructure to be part of the go-to portfolios of infrastructure investment. Let's get more engineers modeling their specifications so that we can better compare green and gray solutions. There's just so much room for innovation here.
Roger outlined some of the innovations and ways of thinking that he believes deserve greater attention.
Climate, people, nature. These are the 3 key things that we need to get right, you know. Climate, which means concentration of people and activities, means decarbonization at scale. So you can't go big time. It means decarbonizing buildings and decarbonizing transport with public transport systems, active mobility, electrification of fleets, and so far. So that's the decarbonization. That's the climate piece. Nature, nature, nature. Stop with the juxtaposition of the cities versus nature. They can be one interdependent and complementary kind of ecology that provides benefits in either way. So that's the nature bit. And the people, we need a different metrics to value the success of cities. It's not GDP. It's not how big or how dense you are. It is how much accessibility to urban services you provide to all people.
Roger also highlights the fact that all the work to implement these approaches and build the cities of the future is, in fact, a way to provide jobs and to be the backbone of a green economy.
When we talk about solution, we often talk about costs. But in the solutions that I talked about in nature, but also in decarbonization, retrofitting buildings, electrifying buses, there's a huge job opportunity. So the biggest jobs per amount of invested million dollars are in retrofitting buildings, are in solar, are in nature-based solutions, are in circularity. So we can create an economy in these cities that is based on all the solutions that we discussed. That is one of the biggest opportunities that national economies and the international community have at hand.
Panning out a bit farther, Joanna asks us to appreciate how urban areas are part of much larger natural systems that transcend the municipal boundaries of a city. If we can break out of the traditional boundaries of what we think constitutes a city, then we may just start including different voices and making different choices.
I think the other thing that we need, resonating with this whole conversation so far, is an integrated way of thinking at the scale of natural systems. We think in units of people systems, of organizations, of cities. All of these are important. They're the ways that we work, but they exist on a spectrum of things that do not respect those boundaries. A city that is on a river is a part of a watershed that expands way far outside of the administrative boundary of that place. So we need ways of working, of engaging people, and engaging policy that does honor those relationships and those scales. And that, I think, transcends like any one of these concrete vehicles like sustainable transportation or last mile warehousing or, you know, sustainable procurement of building materials or smart cities and digitizing of the electrical grid so we can have redundant power sources. All of these things we need. We need better systems for deciding what and how and who's included in those choices.
This concept of thinking beyond the borders of a city's limit makes sense. What's an example of what happens when a city doesn't take into account those larger natural systems?
There are examples, right, in the world of where a project is technically protecting against flooding, but ultimately is going to create a lot more problems than it solves for. For example, the Mekong River Delta is like one of the largest river systems in the world. It goes up through four or five different countries. There's damming that is reducing the sediment flow that makes its way down towards the delta. The delta is losing mass, and the cities are getting bigger and bigger and pushing down the land and subsiding the land. So the land is sinking. It's getting lost to sea level rise and a lack of sedimentation. Meanwhile, all of these dams keep going up, and those dams are fragmenting migratory patterns, reducing the water quality of the river itself, causing mass erosion events. So when any one of those projects, like a dam project for hydropower, which is like sometimes thought of as a greener energy source, has its own huge consequences, especially when it's rinsed and repeated up a whole river system. But when the environmental review that tends to be overseen by a national government is only legally bound to a 10-mile radius around that dam. Of course someone would approve it, right? Check, it's fine. It's totally not fine. So there's a set of legal structures too that national governments have a lot of authority over, but those laws are not written in a way that really accounts for how these things work.
Decarbonization at scale, centering equity in design choices, retrofitting buildings, electrifying transportation, and thinking at the scale of natural systems. These ideas and others like them are Earthshot ideas. Big changes like these don't come easily, though. Transforming how people think is no simple task. Convincing decision makers and other urban stakeholders to all agree on something is near impossible. And the investments needed to fund these kinds of projects can seem elusive. There is no choice but to face these challenges, however. Joanna argues that the traditional ways of building cities, financing urban infrastructure projects, and making decisions simply isn't a workable model anymore.
What's needed is a paradigm shift of getting money for and capital for planning ahead of time and mitigating impacts ahead of disaster recovery. Right now, there's a really bad cycle of paying for damages after an event has occurred and building back the same thing as it was before. Increasingly, communities around the US and around the world can't do that psychologically, spiritually, culturally, and physically, financially, cannot keep doing that. What we need to solve for is how to get ahead of that cycle and to break that cycle. That requires a shift in how political decisions are made, how political legacies are left, how people get votes in office, and how they see success in their terms. It also requires a different way of capturing the economic value of making some of these decisions now that are often not paid back in the timeline that a bank and investors or a politician sees the return that they need to see.
So yes, challenges continue to emerge on this quest to create the green cities of the future. Joanna, Roger, and Anne see these as no reason to throw in the towel or give up, however. They see these kinds of challenges as opportunities.
Right now, there's a massive gap in, I think it's $94 trillion of infrastructure investment will be needed by 2040 around the world. That's a massive gap. It's also a huge opportunity to really transition to a nature-based model of infrastructure development.
Many cities, many professionals talk about municipal finance, but just for your understanding, a city is never able to invest in large infrastructure or nature-based solution at scale from the municipal budget alone. You know, municipal budget comes from real estate taxes, from business licenses, some parking licenses, and the largest share of any municipal budget, also in the developed world or in, you know, successful cities in well-developed countries, comes from national transfers. So a large share of the capital comes from the national authorities through a formula trickling down to cities. So that needs to be understood, and from international investment and private sector investment. And I think we have not been successful in leveraging the private sector, investing in the solutions that we've discussed. For example, the water sector in sub-Saharan Africa is a huge opportunity, but you need to knit the international multilateral development banks, national development banks, and the private sector together around these solutions. Because the private sector is willing to step in, but we need to kind of lower the risk of investment in order to kind of make the solutions viable and to let the money flow where it's needed.
Anne takes this idea of knitting together key players a bit more local and talks about how to break down local government silos. Part of this approach is knowing how to measure the value of ecosystem services and nature-based solutions, and being able to communicate that value across various local government departments.
Often, urban planning uses status quo solutions that too often rely on gray or engineered solutions and governance silos. So a hallmark of nature-based solutions, as we've discussed, is that they provide multiple benefits, and often those benefits cross silos of city government, health departments, transportation, water districts, parks, etc. And we need to find new ways of cutting across those silos so that we can ensure that diverse benefits count. Cities are hubs of innovation, so we need willingness to try new things, to use new science, to measure different things. You know, people always say, you know, measure what matters, and we got to start measuring what matters. Like, for example, in China, they've been piloting using GEP, which is gross ecological product, which is a GDP-like metric that includes the status of natural capital. And they've been piloting it in Chinese cities, as well as at national and regional scales. So we've got to try new things. We've got to do more full assessments of urban ecosystem services so that return on investment can be calculated across those silos, so that we can get parks departments and health departments working together, so that we use public funds earmarked for health to invest in parks. If we understand the multiple benefits that are coming from nature, we can use that understanding to inform decisions. And we need more success stories of cities implementing nature-based solutions and sharing those lessons learned in sort of a peer-to-peer kind of way, so that cities can learn from each other's experiments.
Roger takes this to an even more local level, straight to the people on the ground, those directly affected by urban design choices. And as USAID seeks to increase its efforts to truly localize international development, green cities and urban development may soon be on the front line of those efforts.
The real opportunity of solutions lies in communities and people and smaller organizations, small and medium enterprises that are the fabric, the base of every functional city. You know, cities are not built by multilateral development banks. They're built by people. A lot of the project developers are not necessarily large private capital investment firms. They're people that build, that construct, small developers, but also small and medium businesses that make up the fabric of the city, the services that I talked about. So I think there's a huge potential to unlock, but it means that we as a development community need to look at different ways to activate them for development purposes, or to use the actual power that's already there to unleash it. It means that if we talk about finance, that we need to release much more finance to other type of partners, really different type of NGOs, different type of actors on the ground, which requires us to think in providing smaller budgets faster to other type of partners.
In December 2021, USAID Administrator Samantha Power gave a speech outlining a, quote, new vision for global development, end quote. In it, she spoke specifically about the importance of partnering with local organizations and businesses. The time is ripe for this localized approach to urban development to take hold. USAID is investing in those local communities. Here is USAID Administrator Samantha Power once again.
For
The more localized these efforts become, the more integrated local voices are in making decisions around how cities are being built and rebuilt, the more responsive these urban areas will be to local needs and realities. This creates what Roger refers to as an enabling environment.
So what is actually the enabling environment, the regulatory framework for all these people in cities to act? That also relates to how we enable democratic processes and participatory processes in urban development, for example, because many successful urban developments are not driven by the plan, but by a few entrepreneurs that invest first in a new opportunity. And so in that sense, there's a lot of kind of magic to be done in cities, in communities. And that sounds right, but it becomes also very complex when we think about developing cities in which 50% of the urban community is informal, poor, is in search, not even in search of affordable housing, but is actually in search of no-cost housing, a plot for a shack. So we really need to think about how we can bring these people into the actual planning processes, because a lot of the analytics that we do, a lot of approved understanding of how cities function is not taking this large share of the urban population into account. And that is seriously worrisome. So, and that requires quite an overhaul of how we have done development.
Anne argues that this quest for building green cities requires not just an overhaul of how international development is done. It also requires an overhaul of what is considered a basic need.
No matter who you are, access to nature is important. And there are a lot of kids growing up in cities around the world today who don't have basic needs met. There are a lot of adults who do not have basic needs met. But I would argue that a basic need is access to nature, and that it's not just for the wealthy. It needs to be for everyone. And that's not to say that we don't need to do a better job of meeting those basic needs. So much of the rapid urbanization expected to occur by 2050 will be in Asia and Africa, where many of those new urban residents are going to live in informal settlements on the edges of towns and cities. And you know, something like 1 billion people today live in informal settlements, with more like 2 billion expected by something like 2030. And so we certainly have to think about not only how do we better meet those basic needs of people who are living in those kinds of conditions, but also how do we enlarge our concept of what basic needs are. There's a really cool project that's led by Monash University in Australia that's called RISE, for revitalizing informal settlements and their environments. And that's a really cool example of a program that's using nature-based solutions in informal settlements. Ultimately, their goal is to demonstrate how a nature-based approach can improve health and lessen environmental contamination by improving sanitation and improving access to clean water, and by reducing stormwater impacts.
We are being asked to think differently, partner more locally, build more sustainably, plan more equitably, and make decisions more inclusively. What does all this mean for USAID and other international development institutions moving forward? Joanna suggests creating or updating principle-level standards for what constitutes a good project. She argues that a good project is defined with resilience in mind, solves for inequality and injustice, can directly resource and fund community organizations and marginalized people, and can leverage multiple funding sources.
I think institutions like the World Bank and USAID, the Asian Development Bank, multilateral authorities that help to define this at the global scale, are really important in setting these like principle level standards for what a good project might look like. I think any good project has a number of different features. One, it's defined with resilience in mind. That often means, from my frame, that it's designed for both the current conditions of a place environmentally, but also its future. So has to incorporate future-looking climate projections in the long term into its design. It also has to be done with a rationale for how this solves for a set of complex vulnerabilities in a place. So vulnerability is defined by the physical risk that a place has, but also the social and economic risk of that place, the sensitivities, especially that vulnerable people have to that risk. I think it also needs to solve for inequality and injustice. Understanding that sort of lens of vulnerability is one piece, especially spatially. However, I also think it needs to solve for the direct resourcing of activists and community organizations, upskilling of marginalized people around the world, and empowerment of those populations and communities to be institutionalized into the process of decision-making through governance structures, right? So where management decisions or policy decisions have to include that members of community or members of community organizations or local elected officials are represented fully and equally at the table, legally as well. I think another key element of a good project is one that leverages multiple sources of funds, right? So we've talked about the funding gap that exists for cities, local governments, organizations at many scales in implementing some of these projects. Projects that build resilience of a place have many benefits to them. Benefits that are either direct monetarily, right? They can produce a fee of some kind, they earn revenue, or they're indirect benefits that are harder to capture, social, environmental benefits, for example, or monetize those benefits. So when you're designing infrastructure or a coral reef restoration project, why not include a social scientist in that project to help you facilitate a process with community to unpack what those benefits might be? And then that opens up a whole new way of thinking about layering in other funds that might be used. That means that the $1 of government or public funds that's introduced is just one piece of a pie. I think the other big feature is that anything that we do should be building towards a set of learnings that become a part of a comprehensive approach. We're close to having best practices now, and lessons are transferable. So if I was a funder, I would want to know how the project I'm funding is a part of a bigger strategy. How is it a part of a broader set of learnings that is towards a bigger transformational change? As a funder, I don't expect that change is going to happen with my single dollars, but I want to see that there's lots of benefits that are created when you layer in funds, because you're addressing multiple risks and you're including many skills of people in the process and therefore creating more outcomes. But I also want to see that is a part of an institutional process that's building towards something more transformational.
As we come to the end of this Green Cities podcast series, our guests, Anne, Joanna, and Roger, take us 25 years into the future and paint a picture of what their vision of a green city looks like and feels like.
My vision includes sustainable, equitable, thriving urban systems that are designed for both people and nature. It includes a full recognition that more than any other ecosystems, urban areas are designed by us. They should work better for all of us, wealthy and poor, young and old, human and non-human. They should be good for our mental and physical health. Their infrastructure should protect us from extreme events, and they should welcome nature as an absolutely critical element of their design.
I envision cities that are environmentally and climate just. The communities that are disproportionately impacted by urban development and its impacts, like car-centric development that causes poor air quality in neighborhoods, disproportionately impacts vulnerable communities with urban heat and flooding, includes a inequality in infrastructure availability of healthy, nutritious food, of clean streets, of shady trees in parks. I have a vision for cities that everyone has access to those types of assets in cities, because it what makes for a vibrant city and a life, and that the communities in cities and outside of cities that are disproportionately impacted by climate change, this might be by climate change impacts today, such as those that are flooded or exposed to heat impacts, or those that have been dispossessed by forces of colonization or global economy around the world, traditional owners, indigenous populations. These are communities that have suffered climate injustice for the last 400 years, if not more. I have a vision that we have processes and ways of working and including marginalized communities in these decisions moving forward. I also have a vision that cities are ready to receive people who are displaced by slow-growing climatic events, that cities are the receivers of those with empathy and infrastructure together.
Future cities are beautiful places where people want to live in. Everybody wants to live there because they give you so much benefits. They're healthy places, they're beautiful places, they're lively places, and they provide services to all. And healthy, then I mean really healthy, you know, no air pollutions, safe, you know, no car accidents. So that's a whole different way of looking. Cities are not gray monsters that are terrible to live in, and as soon as you have the opportunity, you move somewhere where it's greener. Cities can be green, cities can be livable, cities can be clean, cities can be safe, and cities are huge emancipatory machines for all people to create a life that they want and they chose themselves to live.
At the start of this podcast series, I said that if you are not yet hooked on urban planning, this series will grab you. It will illuminate the opportunities cities provide in addressing so many international development priorities. I hope we've been able to achieve that goal, and that you are one of the people Anne is talking about in these final words.
People are beginning to pay attention and to recognize that it's time to do things differently. Approaches like ecological planning recognize that cities depend on biodiversity and that biodiversity depends on cities. These kinds of approaches illuminate the linkages between urbanization and biodiversity, and they can inform urban planning strategy and investment. We have the knowledge, the data, the tools and approaches to direct investment in nature to solve many different types of urban problems. Using these approaches today will help cities of the future become more sustainable, livable, resilient, and equitable. And I think that there's a real opportunity for leadership in cities to address the escalating risks and costs of destabilizing Earth's life support systems and of climate change, and that this leadership has to come from cities. The world-class cities of the future are being created today, and we've got to make sure that we're working with and not against nature.
Thanks for coming with us on this journey with Anne Gary, Roger Vandenberg, and Joanna LaVecchio. This episode has been produced by Christina Wong, Elizabeth Doubt, Nirmal Bhagavati, Shane Hofelt, and myself. Music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. The series is brought to you by USAID's Green Cities Division. You can learn more about green cities at www.urban-links.org.